Hello, and welcome to the Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup Podcast. I'm Tom Bondurant, and this week I'll be talking about comics from September 10th, 2009, including Blackest Night, Batman number 2, Booster Gold number 24, Doom Patrol number 2, Green Lantern Corps number 40, Secret Six number 13, Superman World of New Krypton number 7, Titans number 17, and The Unwritten number 5. Let's begin with the Blackest Night books. Blackest Night Batman number 2 was written by Peter Tomasi, penciled by R. Dion Cioff, standard caveats about pronunciations apply, of course, and inked by Vicente Cifuentes. And Green Lantern Corps number 40 was also written by Peter Tomasi, penciled by Patrick Gleason, and inked by Rebecca Buchman, or Buchman. And I talk about these books together because I think they both rely on the sort of cheap emotionalism that I was afraid Blackest Night would devolve into, that being, oh no, I cannot fight you because you are my dead loved one or dead respected comrade or whatnot. Blackest Night Batman, I suppose, gets a little away from that in the scenes where Commissioner Gordon and Barbara have to fight zombified version, or excuse me, Black Lantern versions of dead Batman villains. That's okay. But of course, Batman and Red Robin, have to deal with the Black Lantern versions of their dead parents, in and among the kind of 90s excess spectacle as shown on the cover of, you know, strapping on big flamethrowers and unnecessary pouches and looking, you know, grim and gritting their teeth. And a lot of that in Green Lantern Corps number 40 as well. Aricia runs into her old relatives who we met in the Tales of the Corps miniseries. And of course, Kyle Rayner runs into Black Lantern version of Jade, who actually looks a lot better in death or as a Black Lantern than I expected her to. So the scenes with Kyle and Jade, where Jade looks almost normal, are a little easier to understand because he's not looking at, you know, Jade having been rotting in the grave for low these many months, or actually probably closer to a year now. But still, the point is, whether they get past it or not, and some of them do, obviously all of them do to one extent or another, but they all have to get to this point where they say, oh no, I can fight you because you represent an evil perversion of yada yada yada. And you know, I understand that you're not going to be able to get around that plot element in something like Blackest Night, but at the same time, I don't necessarily want you spending an issue on it. I don't know how much time you spend on it, but it seems sort of excessive and gratuitous. I will say there's more going on in Green Lantern Corps than just fighting Black Lanterns, but not much more. I continue to like Patrick Gleason and Rebecca Buchman's art, but Tomasi's scripting, both in Green Lantern Corps and in Blackest Night Batman, is just a little too on the nose, I think, is what I'm trying to say. It's not, you know, I'm not trying to fault it for sounding too good or too polished. It just sounds too much like a comic book script and not, it doesn't sound natural. That's a short version of saying what I took a long time to say. Plus the fact that it feels more like a Deadman miniseries than a Batman miniseries, especially when Deadman jumps into one of the main characters. But I did think that Cioff and Cifuentes on Blackest Night Batman got the look of Damian, at least the Frank Quitely look of Damian, down pretty well. So there's that. Moving on to Titans number 17, written by Pat McCallum, penciled by Angel Unzueta, and inked by Wayne Fosher. This is a spotlight on Beast Boy, the former Changeling, real name Garfield Logan, who has been a mainstay of the Teen Titans and now the Titans ever since. Well, it depends on how you count, but long history with the Teen Titans, kind of the resident jokester of the new Teen Titans. But it was hard for me to concentrate on Gar's story, even though this was a spotlight issue on him, because I opened up the issue and I saw Donna Troy and her thong. I can't put it any more plainly than that. I mean, I don't consider myself a prude, but it is kind of highlighted later on in the issue. But I mean, come on. DC has a bad enough reputation with Titans starting out as kind of a TNA book, and it really did not need to do something like this, especially considering that these characters aren't getting any younger. And it looks like a desperate cry for help, not just from Donna, but from everybody involved in the... And what's even more unfortunate is that Starfire is right next to her in the image, and she's eating a hot... So there you go. Either I have the mentality of a fifth grader, which is entirely possible, or I don't know. It's all just so Freudian. Like I say, it's unfortunate. As a Beast Boy story, I don't know. This issue is just kind of there. The art is serviceable. I've never really gotten into this Beast Boy and Raven romance. There's a couple of good scenes, or a couple of good pages, I guess, with Cyborg and Beast Boy where he... sort of psychoanalyzes Beast Boy. It all ends up with Gar mentoring the current Teen Titans. And I suppose these little spotlight issues are meant to mean more in the aggregate than they do on their own. I'm certainly been an advocate for done-in-one issues, but this is just kind of average. So nothing real special about the story or the art. May have repercussions later on, but this is not the kind of issue that I would expect a new reader to pick up and want to follow the book. Speaking of the new Teen Titans, the Booster Gold versus Trigon storyline wraps up in Booster Gold number 24, written by Dan Jurgens, penciled by Dan Jurgens, and inked by Norm Rapmund. At this issue... This is one of those reset button storylines. I talked about this, I think, last time I talked about Booster Gold, where the future is just god-awful. Obviously, otherwise Booster wouldn't want to fix it. There's, you know, the days of future past, I guess, scenario where the remaining good guys have to break into the bad guys' headquarters, and there's a, you know, we have to get back to the past. No, I'm not going to leave these people here. They've done so much for me. And meanwhile, our heroes are being picked off left and right. That doesn't exactly happen in this book. And that's good. But still, I had a hard time figuring out why they needed to break into the bad guys' headquarters into the first place if they didn't need to. And at one point, I'm pretty sure Rip Hunter makes it clear that they don't need to, because all they need to do is get in his time bubble and head back to where they can set things straight. Now, maybe I missed something in an earlier issue, and that's entirely possible. But that revelation makes all of the other, you know, craptastic future stuff, like the obligatory graveyard of superheroes, feel not just obligatory, but gratuitous as well. I think this is the second time I've used gratuitous in this particular podcast. And speaking of gratuitous, Zatanna and Green Lantern get some good scenes in the craptastic future. So, I don't know. I'm still not sure that it all holds together. The co-feature, as always, is Blue Beetle, written by Matthew Sturges, penciled by Mike Norton, and inked by Norm Ratmund. This particular co-feature ties into Booster Gold because it features the Black Beetle, who, of course, has been a constant pain in Booster's side since early in Booster series. The co-feature plot basically picks up from Jaime's problems keeping the Blue Beetle Scarab's temper in check. So essentially it's a constantly escalating fight scene, which is to be continued. And I don't know, I like the execution of this feature. There's a funny bit where one of Jaime's friends quotes Mr. T dialogue, and, you know, that's cheap humor, but it's still funny. And there is a bit where Black Beetle tries to convince Jaime that he's some long-lost relative. That fell a little flat for me because of my unfamiliarity with the Blue Beetle ongoing series, which led into this co-feature. But other than that, pretty solid as always. Next is Doom Patrol number 2, with the lead story written by Keith Giffen, penciled by Matthew Clark, and inked by Livesay. This is not quite a complete story in one issue, but no pun intended given the subject matter of the story, but it is a dense storyline. I mean, it's a dense issue. I felt like I was getting a lot of story for my 22 pages. It's a pretty straightforward superhero story with a little bit of pseudoscience. Well, a lot of pseudoscience, but kind of a science fiction feel to it, although I'm not going to say it's hard science fiction by any means. And I thought Clark and Livesay were a little bit more on their game this issue than last. So, all in all, I enjoyed the lead story. The co-feature is Metal Men, plotted by Keith Giffen, scripted by J.M. DeMatteis, and drawn by Kevin McGuire. And it is just as funny as last issue, focusing mostly on gold, platinum, and copper, with, a little bit of tin worked in somehow. So I don't really have much to say about Doom Patrol number 2, except that it's solid superhero action on in both features, and pretty much the level of quality humor that you've come to expect from Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis and Kevin McGuire on The Metal Men. So I think I'm just going to stop right there for Doom Patrol. Next is The Unwritten number 5, written by Mike Carey and drawn by Peter Gross. This is the start of a new story arc, which may confuse some people, maybe not a lot of people, but it's a little bit of a shift, I suppose, in plot, considering that the last issue ended on a cliffhanger, and this issue picks up in a completely different place and time. Anyway, it's a backstory issue focusing, of all things, on Rudyard Kipling and his relationship with Mark Twain, among other details. Carey and Gross present Kipling as something of an apologist for the British Empire, and honestly, I don't know enough about Rudyard Kipling's life to say whether they get the details right or not, especially the Mark Twain stuff. But I did read Just So stories when I was in elementary school, and they get, if they're doing a pastiche, they did it pretty well. In a nutshell, this issue explains how Kipling fits into the larger unwritten storyline, which, of course, looks like a conspiracy stretching back at least 150 years, involving various authors and creative types and attempts to rule the world through them. And I found it to be, it's a kind of complex plot, just for this issue, and I don't know what's important to emphasize and what isn't. I will say that there is a scene where Kipling suffers a tragedy that I thought was very effective and rather chilling. I won't say that made the issue for me, but it was an effective bit of storytelling. And I'm looking forward to seeing where Carey and Gross go with it all. I enjoy Gross's work for his ability to sort of capture 19th and early 20th century an atmosphere. And his Mark Twain, I don't know, I think I've been scarred for life by the Mark Twain episodes of Star Trek, Gross did a good job with Twain, who obviously I do know a little bit something about. So another good issue of Unwritten, and looking forward to issue number 6. And speaking of 6, it's Secret 6 number 13, written by Gail Simone, penciled by Nicola Scott, and inked by Doug Hazelwood. Oh boy, this is another issue of Secret 6 where our heroes or anti-heroes do some weird and or despicable and or fetishistic things, and Simone and Scott and Hazelwood pull it off. Secret 6 is a book that, it's hard to explain my affection for Secret 6. I think it does come down to this admiration for the talents of everybody involved. I mean, when you have a sequence where one of the main characters essentially picks over the body of an unconscious Wonder Woman, and it manages to be both creepy and funny and kind of makes your skin crawl, but you don't hate yourself for reading the book, I think that's something of a trifecta there, or a superfecta. I didn't count how many elements were in that sentence. Anyway, the Sixers are still on the mysterious island trying to free the Bona Migdal Amazons. There's some mysterious weird creature who's still not identified, who's somehow important to the plot. And it looks like, everything's going to hit the fan next issue. There have been a number of fan-hitting moments teased so far. But, again, it's a testament to Simone and Scott's abilities as storytellers that they've managed to just ramp up the tension and the ickiness with every issue. Oh, I forgot to mention, I was just looking at the cover for the credits. Carlos Rodriguez is also listed as a penciler, and Rodney Ramos and Carlos Rodriguez are listed as additional inkers. There are some flashbacks in here, which I presume that they drew, and they fit pretty seamlessly with the main story. They are flashbacks involving Scandal Savage, which, Scandal Savage's childhood, I'll just let you imagine that. And finally, it's Superman World of New Krypton number 7, written by James Robinson and Greg Rucka, and drawn by Pete Woods. This issue, there is a lot of plot in this issue. This is beginning the second half of World of New Krypton. The miniseries finds Superman returning the Kryptonian assassin's body to New Krypton. Kal-El gets a promotion in light of General Zod's, the attempt on General Zod's life, and leads to a confrontation of sorts with Ursa. I never knew Superman. Superman Okay, let me collect my thoughts here. There's the confrontation with Ursa, which isn't really a confrontation. It's just a nice scene between Kal-El, Superman, and Ursa. Ursa loves Zod. Kal-El recognizes that. They kind of share, I won't say they share a moment, but they have a good scene together. But then Kal-El confronts the guy who he realizes betrayed him to the anti-Zod forces. And I don't know who wrote this, whether it was Robinson or Rucka or some combination of the two, but it is a devastating scene. I mean, it is like, you know, Superman's reputation hinges on him being friends with everybody, and his immense capacity for, you know, I'll just say his immense capacity for being people's friends. Superman doesn't go out to make enemies. I mean, he has enemies, but it's not like he goes out of his way to. That's right. It's not like he goes out of his way to alienate people. So when he confronts this guy, this fellow who he realizes stabbed him in the back, and calls him pal with such a loaded term with Superman, considering that his pal, you know, with a capital P back on Earth is Jimmy Olsen, calls this guy pal, it's like, oh my gosh. He sticks the knife in and he twists it. And I never knew Superman could be that. He's not really vicious, but it's just like you can hear the disappointment in his voice. You can, you know, you can almost taste the disappointment in the air. It is just a really effective scene. And and by the way, the Thanagarians show up and there's a big fight in space between Kryptonian and Thanagarian forces. And that comes off pretty well. Except at the very beginning, I had trouble identifying who was Thanagarian and who was Kryptonian, because the Kryptonian ships kind of look Thanagarian and vice versa. But that's all Pete Woods. I think he does a pretty good job with the battle. It's mostly conveyed wordlessly, so good job, Pete Woods, on that. And with that, we bring this edition of the podcast to a close. I know I missed some issues. That's because I got to the comic shop late. So next time we'll be talking about Warlord and two issues, if I'm lucky, of Wednesday Comics. And I'll try and have that up and running by the weekend. So thanks as always for listening, and I will talk to you in a few days.